Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
It's a big night for Gareth Southgate tonight. Back at Wembley, of course, 4 months after the last international. I mean, things could hardly have gone better for him, really, over the last 8 or 9 months, other than obviously losing in the semi-final. Had England won the World Cup, I suppose it could have gone slightly better. But realistically, this is probably the best Gareth Southgate could have hoped for in his World Cup year and beyond. They've been fabulous in the Nations League, beating Spain in the way they did. That brilliant late winner against Croatia. It's been a lot of high points. But we're now back to what I can generously describe as the humdrum. The humdrum of international football, which is the qualifiers. Because the Nations League was a wonderful breath of fresh air that really, I think, reinvigorated us all when it came to international football. I think we'd all got bored of it, fair to say. Watching England win 1-0 against Lithuania thanks to a Wayne Rooney penalty isn't that exciting, I'm afraid. And the Czech Republic are not a great opponent either. I think that's part of the problem. On paper, they're the best in the group, but frankly, this group includes Bulgaria, Montenegro and Kosovo. They're not good. They're ranked 44 in the world. They're below Scotland, and we know how dreadful they are at the moment. Plenty of people will remember the great Czech Republic team with Pavel Nedved, Tomáš Rosický, Jan Koller, Patrick Berger even. You know, some really brilliant players in the late 90s and early 2000s, but they are not that now. They got belted 5-1 by Russia before Christmas. You know, they've ground out the odd result. They won away in Poland and Slovakia, so I don't think they necessarily should be underestimated, but this has the potential to be a crack in the rails on Southgate's hype train. There's plenty of very forgettable wins under Hodgson in those qualifiers, and I don't want to see another one of them. Even the band got bored, for goodness sake, and that band get bored of nothing, tedious as they are. Southgate has been blessed with lots of public goodwill since actually winning a shootout, beating Spain in Seville, a late win over Croatia. But I think this is going to be a different kettle of fish. Wembley's nearly a sellout, but it's not a sellout. And I think there could be a little air of malaise, a sort of expectation of being entertained that might quickly turn into paper aeroplanes and jeers if England don't score in the first half hour, for example. But I think Southgate could seize the initiative, actually, with the team that he names. It would be very easy for him to pick, say, Jordan Henderson, Eric Dier, Dele Alli in the midfield, you know, which I think would be pretty uninspirational. I happen to think Jordan Henderson is worthy of that place. I don't think Eric Dier is terrible either, but there's a lot of England fans out there who don't want to see them playing those roles. I think that's a little harsh, but so be it. Some fans don't agree. Now, I know the Czech Republic shouldn't be underestimated, but if he's going to call up the likes of James Ward-Prowse, Declan Rice, Callum Hudson-Odoi, he should be prepared to play them. And it's almost impossible not to qualify for these Euros, and Southgate's going to learn a lot more about them if he starts them in a game like this, which has a competitive edge, than in a friendly. Not that I think we have any friendlies, actually, although we might book the odd warm-up game when the Euros swing around. So I think it's important that he puts them in now. In these games, it's at home, so that's an advantage. You can say it's a little bit of a softer introduction for some of them. But I think he needs to start putting them in games where it really matters, so that when we get into a game against Colombia and they show something different, they show us a more aggressive side of football, these guys aren't coming on saying, well, all I've ever done is play 20 minutes at the end against Lithuania. This international football lark's easy. I think you need to give them that reality check and say, right, the pressure is on you to perform tonight. I want to see James Ward-Prowse. I want to see Callum Hudson-Odoi. Southgate, I think, knows this. I think he knows that this is different from playing at club level, and he needs to give them the chance. It's not been interesting to hear his selection policy. He says it's not straightforward because it's 4 months since the last game. There's got to be an element of what players are doing with their clubs and what they've done with us. Look at Fabian Delph. He's not been playing for Man City, but he was our best player against Croatia. Trying to balance all of that has been difficult. That's very interesting because you look at someone like Callum Hudson-Odoi getting very little opportunity to play the biggest games at Chelsea. Almost no opportunity, frankly. I think Southgate has to take it upon himself now. I think he has to say, you know what, this is like Club England. This is our own football club. And I'm just going to exist outside the constraints of club football. I'm going to give Callum Hudson-Odoi a starting berth. I'm going to teach James Ward-Prowse how to kick people in midfield. I'm going to convince Declan Rice to play a more expansive passing game. Forget what the club coaches are doing. They'll do their own thing, frankly, no matter how many times Gareth Southgate rings them. There's no reason we shouldn't view Southgate as a man who can legitimately develop and help out these players. Speaking of Gareth Southgate, his old teammate, England teammate Paul Scholes, of course, dramatically resigned after just 31 days in charge recently. We've been hearing much more from Oldham owner Abdellah Lemsagam. He says he didn't interfere with management affairs and that the Manchester United legend resigned by text. And now Lemsagam has told Sky Sports News he only spoke to one player while Scholes was boss.
3 weeks with, 21 days or something away. How am I going to be interfered to his job or something if I'm way already? I've been in Dubai to see my family. And, yeah, was never coming to interfere for his job or something.
I mean, this war of words, I think, won't go away. Both trying to defend reputations. Oldham today have appointed caretaker Pete Wild as head coach until the end of the season. Pete Wild, of course, is the guy who had a ticket for the FA Cup game against Fulham, only to find that he was given a rather better seat as the manager on the bench. And, of course, they recorded a famous FA Cup victory over, well, frankly, it's Fulham, so maybe that takes the edge off it a bit. But he's now got the full-time gig until the end of the season. He won 4 of his 8 games, which is 3 more than Paul Scholes managed. So I suppose it's an upgrade. Well done to Oldham on that one.
Love sport.
Now, anyone who listens to the show regularly knows that boxing is a big passion of mine. And we're lucky in Britain to have had an absolute procession of brilliant boxers coming out of the amateur game. And today, another one has arrived. Dalton Smith has turned pro. I'm delighted to say that he is on the line now to give us the lowdown. Dalton, how excited are you to have turned professional?
Thanks for welcoming me on the station. I'm super excited for the next chapter in my career. I'm becoming a professional fighter under the stable of Matchroom and having the backing of Sky. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the next journey.
Why now? Because I remember reading a few bits and pieces that you were looking at the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games, but obviously that's beyond you now because you had to be amateur to compete there. Why did you end up turning professional now?
Yeah, well, to be fair, before Christmas, it wasn't an option for me to turn professional because as far as I knew, I was just going to stick in the amateur game and hopefully qualify for the Olympics. But then AIBA, the main organisation of amateur boxing, they brought the rule in to change the weights and take two male weights out and put two female weights in for the Olympics. And it just messed all the weights up for me and my weight category got changed. And as an amateur fighter, you have to make weight every single day you're fighting. I'd have struggled to do that. So I had to sit down with my dad, who's also my coach, and we just thought it'd be the right decision to turn over.
I know you've been training alongside and you've known for a long time Charlie Edwards. Did seeing him win a world title last year, did that make you a little bit impatient to get going on your career as well?
Yeah, it does have a little impact on it. You know, seeing Charlie win the world title, it's what every boxer dreams of doing. And seeing Charlie do that, it gives you that hunger to, push on and hopefully one day I can achieve that. And, I've got full confidence in myself and I believe I can.
Now, the attraction of working with the likes of Eddie Hearn and Matchroom is obvious, but how did that relationship come about? Did they come to you? Did you go to them?
I think Matchroom do have me through the amateurs anyway, but I've got a good team around me and, they're sort of the relationship with me and Matchroom and we just come to an agreement and, now I'm signed up under Matchroom.
It's great to have another British guy, as I say, coming through the ranks. Now, you've got a lot of experience, obviously, in the regular amateur game, but also in the World Series of Boxing. Now, to non-boxing fans, that's essentially slightly longer bouts, and they're 5 rounds as opposed to 3, and it's a little bit closer. It's what I always call semi-pro boxing, and you fight a lot of people from all around the world. How important was that experience to you in terms of preparing you for another step up?
I'm a big fan of the World Series of Boxing. Like you say, it's virtually a professional fight, but you're fighting the best fighters across the world. You know, like Cubans, your Kazakhs, which people who don't know boxing, they're the strongest countries in the amateur game. Yeah, like I was just saying, like I've already done the 5 3-minute rounds, so transitioning to the professionals, I don't think it'll be too much of a change. Obviously, with having the World Series of Boxing behind me.
Now, you will have come across some really great amateur fighters, but presumably in the World Series of Boxing, I don't know, would you have overlapped with the likes of Joe Joyce? I know he spent a long time fighting in that, in a different weight division, that is.
Yeah, like I said, the likes of Joe Joyce and all the other fighters who went to like the Rio Olympics. I was on the squad for a couple of years with those, and obviously to see how they've progressed in the career, it's, you know, it gives me that motivation to push on and achieve what all the past Olympians have done.
And just finally, I know Eddie. I mean, in the press release that I was sent today, Eddie was talking about, you know, world title winners that he's had, mentioned Charlie Edwards, and saying he expects you to follow in his footsteps. Now, what are your early goals? Because we can't have you fighting for a world title quite yet.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm not going to start shouting I'm going to be a world champion in the next year or so. Cause I know that's not going to happen. I just want to stay active and, you know, make a name for myself and a statement in the professional ranks, and then maybe next year fight for maybe the English or something like that. Just push on to a smaller title and just progress like that.
And just finally, I want to ask you a little bit. You mentioned that your dad, Grant, trains you. He brought you up as a single parent. How close is that relationship? And does it sometimes get difficult having your dad as your coach as well?
Yeah, I think with a father and son relationship, it either works or it doesn't. And like, my dad's coached me since I was 5, 6 years old, and it's working up to now. So I've got full confidence in me and my dad going all the way, and I can't see me being with anybody else guiding me in my career.
Yeah, brilliant. Dalton, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute delight to speak to you.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you for having
cheers,
me.
Cheers, and all the best. I'm sure we'll speak to you further on down the line. That's Dalton Smith, newly turned professional boxer. And they just keep coming, frankly, in Eddie Hearn's stable. He keeps picking up some of the best amateur talent around. Dalton has got a lot of different amateur belts and amateur medals under him, and so he will come in with a serious reputation. And the World Series of Boxing, you mentioned it there. Yeah, they fight 5 rounds, they go around the world in teams, and they do fight some of the more interesting fighters. Because if you fight at the amateur level, you do tend to end up fighting the same sort of people, and you get to know the circuit a bit. So I think it's great that there is this system where guys can go into a different level. They can go and find fights all over the world, and it expands you. It's the kind of thing which is very important to do, because I think you basically need that in order to become a better boxer. Now, the frustration in professional boxing, that's one end of it. Dalton Smith turning pro, brilliant. So excited to see what he can achieve. But at the top end, in the heavyweight division, we've got 3 fabulous heavyweights, none of whom are fighting each other this summer. Tyson Fury, it looks like, is going to take on Germany's Tom Schwartz. 24-year-old is 24-0, but not really a particularly impressive record. He's really beaten no one particularly good. Knocked out Samir Nebo, for example. He was stopped for the German title in February, but he's also lost to David Allen, so that's no great shakes. He beat Sanad Gashi, who's taking on Chisora in April. Nothing there. So it's annoying because Deontay Wilder is not fighting Tyson Fury. Anthony Joshua is fighting Jarrell Miller. And Tyson Fury now is going to look like he's going to go and fight Tom Schwartz. We need to get these heavyweights in with each other. But the problem is, Tyson Fury put pen to paper on an $80 million deal with ESPN, a 4-fight deal. Now, what that means, ESPN have paid him so that his next 4 fights will all be on ESPN, and they'll try and make as much money out of them as possible. But think about it. They're not going to put him in with Wilder again straight away. What if he loses? What if he gets sparked out? All of a sudden, they've paid $80 million for 1 fight and a bloke who then doesn't have much of a reputation to trade off afterwards. So that is a concerning situation, because that's now going to mean that probably Fury's not going to get in for a big fight. Maybe until his 3rd ESPN fight? That means it's probably at least a year away for that great rematch, which means that likely Joshua will say, I'm not fighting either one of you until you've got that business sorted. AJ's got a little bit further away. It's so frustrating. Very interesting to hear. Alexander Usyk, of course, the unified cruiserweight champion. He also beat Tony Bellew. He's agreed to take on Carlos Takam in a heavyweight bout on the same night as Deontay Wilder and Dominic Brazil clash. I think that's a great fight for Alexander Usyk. He's obviously an extremely talented fighter moving into heavyweight because he wants to challenge for the big belts there. Takam, well, I'll tell you this much, he's got a very, very hard head.
This
is Love Sport.
The Gallagher Premiership is back this weekend. Stars of the Six Nations back in domestic action. Leicester take on Northampton Saints tonight, while Saris are facing Harlequins on Saturday afternoon at the London Stadium. Billy Vodopola, one of those gracing West Ham's home ground, and he spoke to Love Sport Radio earlier this week on behalf of Land Rover, the official vehicle partner of Premiership Rugby.
We're both in the top four. We're both vying to be in semi-final. And that's probably the biggest source of the rivalry, I guess. Probably saw the first time we played them at the Stoop. It was quite tasty, so we'll see what Saturday has to bring up. It's nice that we can get our some of our games mixing in with some of the football stadiums, and it's always nice playing at stadiums like the London Stadium. We had Wembley a few years ago. You know, it's always nice to mix it up, and we expect nothing less than a physical battle.
That's Billy Vodopola talking about the rivalry between Saris and Quins. Has he got a point to prove, do you think, coming back? A lot of these England guys probably had a slightly disappointing Six Nations after the high of that win over Ireland. Since then, really not a lot to shout about. Do you think there might be some added aggro in that game because of it?
Yeah, I think there will be. I think there's a great little narrative that's going on, particularly in that game. I think you're right to say that England players have got a point to prove. I think, actually, Billy Vodopola, maybe more than any, and I do have sympathy with him because he's missed so much rugby over the last maybe 2 years or so, and it's been very difficult for him to create any kind of rhythm, but he did play all five of our games in this championship, and I would say he was actually one of our more disappointing players, even in that great win against Ireland and Dublin, the thrashing against France. I don't think he really was at the fore. I don't think he did badly, but again, when we were kind of up against it against Wales and Scotland, I wouldn't have said he really stepped up. And he's a guy both with a good amount of experience now and an even bigger amount of ability, and I think he's someone that in the past at his best we've looked to change momentum in games, to essentially stop any kind of fight back from an opposition. I don't think we saw that from him. So yeah, I think he's got a point to prove. And on the other side of it, on the Harlequin side of it, you've got two guys in particular, maybe three if you throw Chris Robshaw in, but particularly Mike Brown and Danny Kerr. These are guys with massive points to prove because they didn't even feature at all. They didn't feature in any matchday squad for the Six Nations. And as recently as a year ago, you'd have had them down as certainly vying for a starting place in Kerr's case and probably on the team sheet in Brown's case. It was only really in the autumn that Elliot Daly became established as that starting fullback ahead of Mike Brown. And yeah, they're both in their 30s now. But I was reading a Mike Brown interview today and he was saying that, you know, they're just trying to focus on their rugby at Harlequins, enjoying it. They're having a really good season, Quins, remember, up in third place and not far behind Saracens. So they've got real incentive to fight for a premiership title for Harlequins is not out of the question at all. And they know that the better they play for Quins, the stronger their case to get back into the England setup becomes. And especially in Kerr's case, actually, with that blood clot that Dan Robson's apparently suffered, horrible injury, health issue, whatever you want to call it, that could see him ruled out of the World Cup. There is a scrum half place fully up for grabs, and Danny Kerr, it was unthinkable that a year ago that he wouldn't be in the squad for the Six Nations, but that's what happened to him.
Yeah, and of course Ben Spencer is, you know, someone, as you say, he's got a massive opportunity now and could add a little bit of spice to that scrum half position. I mean, I think Ben Young is obviously great. I think he's England's most capped scrum half again now.
He is just gone ahead of Danny Kerr.
There was a period where they kept sort of overtaking each other, but I think that could add something different. I kind of love with the Saris have literally named their team in the last minute, so you won't have seen it, but it's all the stars that you might expect. I kind of love that you've got, you know, Billy Vodopola, disappointing Six Nations. You've then got a back three of Sean Maitland, very disappointing Six Nations. David Strettle, a guy who probably thinks he might, probably should be part of the Six Nations. And Liam Williams, who is now the king of the Six Nations. I kind of think that he is someone who has come on so much in the last, 2 years. You think about that Lions tour, right? When he went and he played at fullback against, I think, the Hurricanes, and he got caught out a couple of times in a high ball, he got sin-binned, and I thought, surely they can't start this guy in a Lions test. And he absolutely grew into it. What a player.
Oh, fantastic player. Liam Williams, a great story. He was a scaffolder at the same time when a lot of other guys who have gone on to play at the same level as him were already in academies or possibly even playing professionally. And he is that rare thing in Test rugby, I would say now, somebody who doesn't rely purely on power or even for the majority on power, and somebody who Warren Gatland has been prepared to take a risk on. It was absolutely a risk when he picked him at fullback for the Lions series. And and it was one that ultimately paid off, like all the big decisions did. Okay, we didn't win that series, but a draw was a heck of a lot better a result than a lot of people thought we'd get. And he's improved under the high ball, as he was always going to do by playing more at fullback, and he has always had the most brilliant instinctive running game and ability to offload under pressure, and also to essentially go for gaps and go for breaks where a lot of other players wouldn't even see it, let alone back themselves to go for it. So yeah, he's a fantastic player to watch. And when you just mentioned a couple of those names there, you're reminded of the strength that Saracens have. Yes, they're 8 points behind, or 10 points behind, sorry, Exeter in the Gallagher Premiership, but Exeter don't have the same raft of internationals. That's their that's their incredible strength, don't get me wrong, but it's not an even playing field when Saracens lose their players to international duty and Exeter lose theirs, because there's a massive gulf in the amount they lose. And let's be quite frank, it would be a surprise if it wasn't Exeter versus Saracens competing in the Premiership final again in May.
Yeah, and that's reflected by Harlequins being 7-2 underdogs for the game tomorrow at London Stadium.
Surprises me that, by the way, because the last game between them earlier this season, just 5 points in it. Harlequins won one of the games last season. It's by no means a done deal, I would personally say.
3 o'clock kickoff tomorrow. And by the way, I've checked this because I was going to go and it's clashed with something else. Tickets still available, £17 for that.
That's good.
To go to the London Stadium and watch two of the best teams in England, and actually, at full strength, two of the better club teams in the world.
Very good size with some needle in that game. And we know, don't we, earlier this week it's being confirmed that that game in future, because it's been played at Wembley for a few years, will actually be at Spurs' new stadium from next season.
Well, assuming they're open. Yeah, I was going to say, let's not count our chickens until the eggs have hatched. Tonight, though, there's a big game at Welford Road. Leicester facing Northampton Saints. George Ford happy to add a little bit of fuel to the fire of that rivalry this week. He's been talking up Northampton in form, but actually saying that Leicester have got a lot to prove. Great battle at 10 there, because of course Dan Biggar, the star of the Six Nations, the super sub, will be starting for Northampton Saints, with George Ford, another quote-unquote super sub,
finisher,
starting at 10 for Leicester. Really nice little matchup.
Talking of needle as well, the East Midlands derby, really, it is quite a spicy game, that one. And yeah, I think it should be a close contest. You look at where the teams are on the table, they both want to be higher. In particular, Leicester, seeing them in 10th, I know it's very tight down there, there's only a few points between a few teams, but that's a very, very disappointing season for them. They've got a point to prove, and hopefully it'll be a good atmosphere there. It's Manu Tuilagi's first game in Leicester colours since deciding to stick with Leicester, turn down the big money, move to France. So that'll be one for the fans to get behind, if you like. And yeah, it's always a spicy atmosphere there for that game, and it's a tough one to call. I'd say with home advantage, it'll be Leicester. You talk about players with a point to prove in George Ford, Manu Tuilagi, and a couple of others as well. They've certainly got those. Ellis Gens, don't forget him. And Dan Biggar, he's obviously coming into it full of confidence. I saw an interview with him in the Times today, and this is a separate note, really goes back to the international stuff that we've slightly moved on from in the last week or so. But he says, if I could give any advice to any international coach, it would be write Sean Edwards a very big check. And I just wonder if England and the RFU are having some thoughts about doing exactly that to both Sean Edwards and Warren Gatland around about now.
I wonder if Wigan Warriors wish they'd got Sean Edwards to sign a contract 3 months ago when they said they would.
You wonder? You have any doubt?
And he just went... And he said, all right, yeah, let's do it. When I leave Wales end of the year, yeah, I'll come and work for you. And they went, we'll sort the contract eventually. And it's got lost in some paperwork. And now he's sitting there going, well, I'm technically unemployed, actually. So,
come at me.
This is Love Sport.
Now, I want to talk a little bit of Northern Ireland, because they secured a 2-0 win over Estonia last night. It wasn't perfect. It wasn't easy. But it was a great result, given that they still had to play Germany and Holland in their group. We're joined now by former Northern Ireland and Manchester City midfielder Jim Whitley. Jim, can they get through this group of death? Are we starting to hope?
The group of death, yes, I suppose it is the group of death. Well, they've started very, very well. And they've got Belarus as well to follow. They need to get points in the bag because, as we know, Germany and the Netherlands are going to be tough to beat. They did so well in the last campaign that you never know. But it is a very, very tough group and a big ask, to be honest.
I felt like when Paddy McNair headed that ball inexplicably over, you know, headed from about 3 yards, it might be one of those nights where Northern Ireland created a lot of chances and ended up with a very disappointing 0-0 draw. Were you impressed with the character that they showed to actually persist with it and come out in the second half and find that goal?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, that miss in particular, I mean, he rose so well, and as a player, to miss from such a short range, you sometimes... It'll be,
well, he did everything right, because he didn't head it over, he headed it down, and then it...
down, exactly, which is what you're always told as a kid, to head down. And he did that, and yes, I thought, oh, it's going to be one of those games. But they came out and showed character. They didn't concede, which is fantastic. So they proved themselves as professionals to come out and beat a team, which I think a lot of people, because of their last campaign, would expect them to beat. And they were fantastic in the end.
Where do you think this Northern Ireland side are? I mean, you know, they've had days in the sun, that tremendous qualifying campaign with the likes of David Healy, but they've not had the major championships, perhaps, that they would have liked. Do you think that this is starting to look like a unit that can reach those major championships one way or another?
Oh, it's very, very tough because they did so well last time, and Michael O'Neill has done a fantastic job, and I'm not sure if he'd pushed them as far as he could at one stage. You know, there's a lot of the big teams in particular look at all the top players that are playing for their respective countries, and Northern Ireland, George Drew Spade, is only having two premiership players at the minute playing for them. But as a team, and what he does, what Michael O'Neill does for them, is they do something right together. And when they come together as a group, they always seem to perform. But they had a little slump just of late, and I know this has been the first win over 9 competitive matches. However, you know, this is Euros, and what a time to start winning games again. So you never know. What he's done for Northern Ireland is magnificent, and keep that team morale going, and it can only go one direction.
And Windsor Park was absolutely bouncing last night. It was, what a spectacular atmosphere that place is when it really gets going, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, in my time when I played, I think we had some great players, but probably didn't apply ourselves as good as these group of players are right now. And the feeling that the fans and results are proving is it's that bouncing atmosphere at Windsor Park. It is fantastic. We'll put other teams off, but as a group of players, they're doing brilliant.
Jim, I just want to ask you, because I know that you spent quite a long time at Wrexham, and I've been taking some flack today, actually, which does happen more than you'd think, after I criticised Ryan Giggs for not playing Gareth Bale when Wales hadn't played in Wrexham for 11 years, and they went back there during the week and played basically a second 11. I wonder, surely that's a real disappointment to the town when Wales come to town. They so rarely play in North Wales, and then, you know, it's basically a team of kids and reserves.
Yeah, I scratched my head at that, to be honest. And I don't know if it's something that he looks at that he did back in the day as a top player, resting some of your players. And Ryan Giggs never turned up for a lot of the friendlies. And
well, no, exactly. But, I mean, he said he didn't feel he had to play, yeah.
Yeah, and yes, for Wrexham, I think if I was going along, you'd want to see the top players. And you don't know what the managers are thinking, what they're planning for the future. I always think when it comes to the likes of Wales, Northern Ireland, you play your best team and try and get results, because you never know, things can backfire on you. But yes, very, very bizarre. But for to be playing at Wrexham, yes, you'd want the best for the fans.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, it's a long way. Getting anywhere, I mean, I don't need to tell you, getting anywhere in Wales takes a long time. But getting from Wrexham to Cardiff seems to take several days each way, as far as I can tell. I just have to ask you finally, Jim, because I know that you started your career at Manchester City. I'm a Liverpool fan, so I'm looking forward to winning the league at long last this year.
Oh, brilliant.
do you think City will get over the line and disappoint me?
Well, do you know what? Now City are in the driving seat, because they were waiting for Liverpool to slip up. It's so tricky. This can go either way. I do think Liverpool performed better just in that second spot. I think the pressure's off them. I thought they were fantastic for the season right until the time they went and started to lead the Premiership. I think then they actually started to look over their shoulder, looking at where Manchester City were instead of, you know, maybe looking at the finishing line. But now City have been here before, and experience does tell in these situations. It really does. And I can only tell you this from experience as a young player going through and retiring, you look back and go, yes, experience will put you in good stead. And they've been there before, and I do think that they will hold it together and produce, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's very disappointing, Jim. I'm afraid you won't be coming back on. Don't worry about it, mate. We'll maybe just lose your number. No, thank you so much for joining us, Jim. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you. That's Jim Whitley, former Northern Ireland and Manchester City midfielder. Of course, Northern Ireland getting that great win over Estonia last night. McGinn and a Davis penalty with 15 minutes to go. But boy, did they need points in that group. Germany and the Netherlands, not a good place to be.
Love Sport.
Not a good day for Scotland yesterday. I grew up as a season ticket holder in Scotland. I've been to watch Scotland a lot. I don't think I've ever seen them win, to be honest. But I'm rather glad I didn't make the trip to Kazakhstan for that game because they were beaten 3-0 indoors, plastic pitch. It's not a thriller. Let's talk to Andrew Dixon, Scottish football journalist. This is the worst result in Scotland's history, isn't it? I know there's a lot of competition for that title.
Yeah, good afternoon. There is a lot of competition. I would say this is probably the worst of the lot, yes. Very poor night for Scotland. Very bizarre claim from Alex McLeish that the game, Scotland started it pretty well, which when you consider they lost two goals in the first 10 minutes to a team which didn't win any of its World Cup qualifiers in the last round of qualifiers, is a bit of a peculiar claim. It wasn't a good night at all for Scotland. And it already puts them on the back foot and leaves them really up against it in a group where you've got Russia and you've got Belgium in there. It's going to be very difficult for them already to get to Euro 2020.
I mean, this is just typical Scotland, isn't it? Every time it gets easier to qualify for a major championship, Scotland make it harder for themselves. I have to wonder, when I look at the guys, you know, I was thinking about Gordon Strachan's comment recently that Scotland were too small biologically to ever compete in world football, which just seemed like backwards nonsense to me. I have to say, when I look at the list of guys who've been in charge of Scotland, there's not a lot of forward thinking in that group, is there?
No, there's not. And I think what you say there is absolutely correct. I mean, Scotland is a country of nearly 5.5 million people now. You have seen countries over the years with that kind of population, less than that, doing very well at a certain level in world football, European football. And you go right back to Denmark winning the Euros in the early 90s. The Netherlands, of course, have been very successful over the years. Most recently, you have Croatia getting to the World Cup final, another relatively small country and a new country as well, in terms of sort of the last 20, 25 years or so.
Well, Iceland. There are more people live in Aberdeen Iceland, than live in Iceland.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, well, I think it was 320,000 people in Iceland. I mean, I live in London, and the borough of Wandsworth, I think, has about the same population as Iceland. So, it's that's your comparison. So, to make that kind of claim is absolute nonsense. Scotland do have decent players. I don't think there's any doubt about that, because you look at the clubs they're playing at, and they do play for these clubs regularly. And the best players in the Scotland squad, guys like Andrew Roberts and Kieran Tierney, who admittedly both of them missed the game yesterday because of injuries, and Andrew Robertson's case, tooth surgery, I think it was, he missed the game with. There are very good players playing for Scotland, but yeah, manager after manager after manager, as the track record would suggest, with Scotland not having been at a finals tournament since 1998, each manager who's been in charge has failed to get the best out of the players at his disposal.
And they look, you know what it was? They looked shell-shocked last night. They looked like legitimately scared of what was going on, especially, and I know the back four didn't really know each other. They're probably still learning first names, to be honest. And I do feel sorry for them in that sort of situation. But surely it has to come down to a mindset thing. You know, Alex McLeish can say they started well if he likes, but maybe he thought they sung the national anthem well, I'm not sure. Because, as you say, they were 2-0 down inside 10 minutes. Do you think there is a problem in Scottish football as a whole that actually when they go into these games, there's so much history of losing to sides like this, you know, drawing in Georgia or losing to Lithuania. I could list them. I just can't bring myself to do it. Do you think that there is now an actual endemic problem with the group of players?
I certainly think the more that time goes on and Scotland still don't get to competition. I mean, the Euros were expanded with countries like Scotland in mind, I think, to an extent, where you know, you go from that smaller tournament to having more teams there, and it's tailor-made for a country of Scotland's standing and at the level that they're at to finally get themselves back into a tournament. And we also, obviously, we know that Scotland, when they have been at tournaments in the past, they bring a great support with them, like all of the other home nations do. It would be great to have them there, but yeah, it's I think the more that time has gone on, it's become, without wanting to use a cliche, it's become a bit of a monkey on their back. It's very, very difficult to shake off. Of course, you have the buffer, if you like, of being guaranteed a playoff place through the Nations League. Of course, Scotland won their group with Israel and Albania. But at the same time, do you really want to be going through this process of, what, 10 games, is it 8 games in the qualifiers to miss out, and then you go into the playoffs anyway? But you'll go into the playoffs. People are talking about, at least we've got that, as if, well, that puts us through. You still have to qualify in those games. And as well, if you're going into those matches off the back of a dismal run of results in your qualifiers, you're going into it in a negative frame of mind against another country which might have actually done quite well of late. And then, of course, you're back to square one once again.
Now, Scotland take on San Marino on Sunday. Usually, I just wouldn't even contemplate it, but it's not possible, is it?
Surely not.
They're 15-1. The draw is 15-1, which is remarkably short given what San Marino are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, come on, we saw San Marino score that famous goal against England after 7 seconds many, many years ago, and I don't know if they've done anything in international football since then. Scotland, of course, should win that game. They should win it quite comfortably. It'll probably be a typical 2-0 Scotland win. It'll be very underwhelming, low-key. But I think at this stage, Alex McLeish is a man who, ever since he came back in to take charge of the national team for the second time, he seems to have been one game away from a crisis throughout his second tenure. You know, he's there now. He's lost 3-0 already to Kazakhstan. He needs a result here. I'm sure he will not care about the performance, whether it's good, bad or whatever, as long as he gets the win. And, you know, if they can. I mean, Scotland have done a bit better, actually, lately against the really small teams in qualifiers against the likes of Gibraltar and what have you. They have actually scored a few goals. So you might see them go and win quite handsomely, actually. But I think it will be one of those games where San Marino will make themselves difficult to break down. Scotland will have to keep chipping away. And, of course, they go into that game off the back of a really demoralising defeat. So San Marino will certainly see their chance. When you're talking about the odds for a draw there, San Marino will see their chance to maybe just cause an upset.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can already see it. You know, an hour gone, 0-0, Scotland getting nervous. Well, desperately hope it doesn't go that way, Andrew. But thank you very much for joining us. And hopefully next time we speak, it'll be in happier circumstances. Maybe even after a Scotland win, heaven forfend. That's Andrew Dixon, Scottish football journalist, talking about that horrible 3-0 defeat in Kazakhstan last night, when Alex McLeish claimed Scotland started well, even though they were 2-0 down after 10 minutes. Not sure what game he was watching.
This is Love Sport.
Ex-Manchester United player Fabian Brandy is the brains behind the new app Scouted. It's dubbed the LinkedIn of football. Scouted aims to help young talent get spotted. I'm delighted to say Fabian is joining us on the line now to discuss his new project. Fabian, tell us a little bit where the idea for this first came from.
Hi, James, you all right?
Yeah, great to have you on, mate.
Yeah, basically, it just come from my experience at Man United. I was there from the age of 8 to the age of 21, so you can just imagine how many, you know, players I saw fall through the net who were actually, like, kind of friends of mine. But they just didn't really have the connections, you know, to obviously go to, like, a club in like, the lower leagues. So then they would just end up falling out of love with football. Obviously, I was fortunate to be at Man United for as long as I was. But unfortunately for my friends, you know, they didn't have the connections to, you know, get a trial or, you know, ask another club, can they train with them? So I think that's where the idea came from and where I was, you know, inspired to, you know, get the app ready, really.
Is it as simple as that when it comes to, you know, when you are a young player? Is it as simple as ringing someone up, you know, and going, oh, will you let me come and train for a session? Is it really almost as Wild West as that?
Well, it depends on what type of what type of player you are. There's obviously the players in the football industry who are actually known. It's quite easy for, you know, them to go to another club because they're already in the system. But usually for those players who have not really, you know, got the reputation like those players, it's harder for them to obviously try and, you know, get into another club. You know, the parents, you know, even might not be able to drive or, you know, anything like that. So it's a bit difficult for players out of the system to obviously get spotted by teams within the football industry.
Now, tell me a bit about how you got picked up then, because obviously, as you say, you were lucky to be at United for quite a long period of time. How did you end up getting in and staying in, I suppose?
Well, with me, I started off at West End Boys, which is a local a Sunday league club up in Manchester. And I was actually fortunate to have a scout from Man United go to. He was, I think he was the caretaker at my primary school. So I already kind of had the link there. So he put me into the Sunday league team. And then, you know, I think Man City, they were inquiring about me. But obviously, I just wanted to carry on playing Sunday league football. And then the caretaker at my primary school, he put me into Man United. And my mum said, you know, you ain't messing this opportunity up. And then obviously, it's just been upwards from there.
And obviously, you know, you didn't necessarily break through into the Manchester United first team other than a couple of appearances, but you still had a very successful career around the Football League. You played overseas as well. And I understand you also represented St Kitts and Nevis at international level as well.
Yeah, I represented St Kitts. I think it was for the 2018 World Cup qualifiers. I think we needed to beat El Salvador to actually enter into the World Cup. And unfortunately, overall, I think we lost. I think it might have been 6-3 on aggregate, but obviously that was a very exciting time for me and, you know, in my football career.
Now, tell me a bit about that time at United, because obviously you were there, I think, between what 98 and 2010. As you say, saw a lot of players slip through there. Also saw a lot of players graduate through the United system, one of whom now has ended up manager. Tell me a little bit about your experience of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as a player.
Yeah, well, as a player, me being at Man United, and because I had Ollie as a reserve team manager, I think it was about two or three years I had Ollie. But you could always see, you know, he was destined to be a manager at, you know, at a top level. He could actually see things in play. He could see assets in players who couldn't even see in themselves. For example, when I was 15. The type of player I am, I like to try and dribble in the box to try and get the perfect shot off. And then Ollie, he was watching that training session and he pulled me aside and he basically said, you know, you don't have to take too many touches in the box and just take a touch and shoot. And then I took that advice on board, and when I was taking a touch and shooting, I was realising the ball was going through, you know, defenders' legs and catching the keeper off guard. And obviously, if anyone's watched Ollie, which I'm sure they would have, that's kind of where most of his goals come from. He doesn't really take, you know, too many touches in the box. But you could always see, you know, he had the managerial, you know, ability to obviously manage at a very top level. And I think, you know, what's key with how he's been successful at Man United is obviously he's good at, you know, he's coaching things and doing things that way. But as a person, you know, he's just one of the nicest guys in football, and he treats everyone the same from first team to the receptionist, and, you know, he's just a very nice guy. So
it's interesting that advice that he gave you about shooting. Do you think you see a bit of that influence? It seems to me, at least, that Marcus Rashford has gone from strength to strength under Solskjaer. Do you think he probably got a similar piece of advice?
Yeah, Ollie, you know, he will be giving advice to, you know, strikers. Mainly, obviously, everyone in every position, but mainly, you know, he'll be giving his advice to strikers. And, you know, you can see the difference between Marcus Rashford since Ollie's come in. You know, he's been more deadly in the box. He's, you know, he's catching the keeper off guard. He's doing things like that. You know, he'll be literally telling Rashford to stay after training and practice his shooting, left foot, right foot. And, you know, you can see Ollie can see what Rashford can actually be. And I think with Ollie there as a manager, you know, Rashford will go on to bigger and better things, more than what he's achieved already.
The way he plays, it's not surprising how quickly he's risen up through the ranks. But I know, for example, that you played a bit of England under-20s, England under-19s. How difficult is it to make the jump from that type of football to senior football? Because I was reading James Ward-Prowse this week saying, you know, and he was very successful under 21 level, but taking him a while to adjust to senior football. Is it very hard to make that step up, you know, to go and start playing quite gritty football with a bit of bite?
Yes and no. You know, with football, I think you have to be mentally strong, and you've got to be prepared for anything. Like with me, I've always thought, you know, if you're good enough, you're old enough, kind of thing. So that's what the, well, that's why, again, you see a lot of players go out on loan, you know, to get senior football and to try and adapt to that level. But, you know, I've always said, you know, if you're good enough, you're old enough. And I think in the football industry, you have to be mentally strong and you have to be prepared for anything.
Fabian, thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating to hear about your new app, Scouted. It's got a database of hundreds of players. You can filter them down to playing style, location. It's the LinkedIn for footballers. It's founded by ex-Man United player Fabian Brandy. Really interesting that, because I feel like youth players, it is very easy to miss out. You look at someone like Declan Rice. He was dropped by Chelsea at the age of 14. And he was lucky, I think, because he came from a footballing family and they looked after him and they knew they could go and get him a trial at West Ham and they knew exactly how to look after him. So I think there are people who can withstand that, but there probably is a lot of talent who got dropped. Look at Jamie Vardy. He never played for a top club for quite some time. He turned out to be an absolute speed merchant who could finish as well.
This is Love Sport.
I want to talk a little bit of cricket, because you may or may not have seen that Durham, who controversially last summer announced that they'd picked up Cameron Bancroft as an overseas professional. Now, they've made him captain. It was already a controversial signing. The reason being, of course, he had just been handed, and they picked him up in July, by the way. He'd just been handed a 9-month ban for his part in the Australian cheating scandal. He had the sandpaper. He tried to hide the sandpaper in his underwear. He tried to drop it on the ground. It was disgraceful. It really was disgraceful. And he was at the heart of it, to be honest. However, Cricket Australia showed him a bit of leniency. They said, look, he was a young player. He's been pressured into it by the likes of Steve Smith and David Warner. But nevertheless, Durham picked him up. Probably got him at a pretty discounted rate, to be honest, because he'd just been banned. He was probably wondering if he might ever get another contract and leapt at the first opportunity to put pen to paper when he got back from his 9-month ban. He's a good batsman, to be fair. He can open in all formats. He averages just under 40 in first-class cricket. Looks like a shrewd bit of business, even if it is a slightly immoral one. What successful businessman hasn't made the odd, slightly unethical decision in their lives just to get ahead? Then we find out this week that they've made him captain. Now, Paul Collingwood was the Durham club captain. He finally retired at the age of about 50, frankly. He just kept going, Paul Collingwood. So they did need a new captain. It's not as though they've sacked one to give the job to Cameron Bancroft. And I'm all for rehabilitation and time served. But I cannot fathom why Durham think this is an appropriate course of action. Fine to give him the contract. He, as I say, he served his suspension. But you don't need to make him captain. The guy's a convicted cheat. That's the simple fact behind it. By the way, he's not even allowed to captain Australia at the moment because part of his punishment was not to be allowed to be considered for a leadership role in the Australia setup for 12 months after the end of his suspension. That ended at the beginning of the year, so he won't even be able to be vice-captain for Australia until 2020. And yet, Durham thought it was appropriate to make him captain. So the Australians, right? Cricket Australia, who created the atmosphere where it was acceptable to do anything to win, to clash with the South Africans in the stairs outside their changing rooms, arguing about people's wives and things. The Cricket Australia, who created an environment where it was acceptable for Cameron Bancroft, the all-smiling, all-dancing young protégé to Smith and Warner, to go out and cheat. To cheat and then to try and cover it up. Even Australia won't touch him, but Durham will. What kind of message does that send to the cricketers in the northeast? Don't worry about cheating, lads. As long as you can blame someone else, you will essentially get away with it. And you can even be captain again a couple of months later. It's outrageous. Some people have been arguing that, and I don't necessarily disagree with this, although overall I do. They've been arguing it's such a young squad, crippled by financial difficulties, ECB regulations. But actually, that's even more of a reason not to give Bancroft the job. The fact that you've got a young squad, a new squad, it's an opportunity to give someone that responsibility and say, you know what, you're someone we rate for the future. Go and captain this side. Try and give us a new start, one of our homegrown talents. And there are plenty at Durham. A lot of good players in that squad. Instead, they've given it to one of Australia's quote-unquote finest, and he will lead the county. Now, I think I know part of the reason why. Apart from perhaps the lack of other people they think can do the job, Marcus North is the new director of cricket. Spent 16 years playing for Western Australia. Would you like to guess which territory Cameron Bancroft plays for? you know what, I'll put you out of your misery. It is, of course, Western Australia, for whom he scored a century on his first-class return last month. Of course it's Western Australia. So it's a massive call for Marcus North. Now, I know Marcus a little bit. I've interviewed him a few times. I've met him. He's an intelligent bloke. He moved to the North East. He fell in love with the North East and literally in the North East. Married a girl up there and now lives there. And he's never really looked back. He runs a wine business. He plays club cricket. You know, he's an all-round good bloke. He now runs Durham. He's director of cricket there. But this looks like a very, very one-eyed decision. It might rub a lot of players up the wrong way, and it might leave him wondering whether actually he should have picked one of Durham's own to take over the captaincy. I don't want this decision to come back and bite him, but I'm very worried that actually it might.
Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.